The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 3, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to see you all. Last week at this time when Jed was talking, he offered a quote by the Buddha that really moved me. It always has. And I thought there's just a few things I want to say about that. It's a beautiful and moving a statement by the Buddha where he said, and this is relating back to the story when he was a child and he found some peace and just sitting quietly watching his breath. But at some point he reflected, "Why am I afraid of that unadorned quietude?" was the line that Jed gave us. And I find that very moving. It's a wonderful question, a great question, because I have known this fear, and I think many of you have as well, and maybe you do even now. But it's even comforting to know that if we do feel this, we might just realize that, you're not alone in this, in feeling this discomfort, this you're afraid, you have this fear of this unadorned quietude, which is the backdrop of the reality that we live out and experience moment by moment, that it is quietness and settledness. And yet very often we seem to be afraid of this, and we find it disturbing. So that's what I want to just explore a little bit today. I was just thinking of different things I could talk to you about in regards to this. But it's interesting to note that this observation was made. Why am I afraid of that unadorned quietude? That this was made at a time, it was made by a person at a time when the world was considerably quieter than we know it today. And I think it's even kind of difficult for us at times, I don't know if we ever really contemplated very much, just how quiet the world is, particularly if we get outside the cities, get into some expansive natural surroundings, we can begin to taste that. But there was a time when it was this way pretty much everywhere. I remember some years ago now, when I was, it had to be 30 or 40 years at least, but I went with a friend. We traveled down into southern Minnesota. And I'm a northern boy. At that time, I was, I might have been living down here then. I don't know, in the cities. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But I remember we traveled down to the kind of the southern border of Minnesota, where we hit Iowa. And but it was still Minnesota. And there's a town there called Harmony. And there's a cave nearby, Harmony Cave. And there's other places around there that have caves. And anyway, we went down to explore some of these. And when we were down there, and we knew it, we were kind of getting into Amish country and hadn't really spent a lot of time among the Amish or visiting their neighborhood there. But once we got down there, it was, there they were. They were very prevalent, seeing them up on the roads with their horse and buggy and that sort of thing. That also moved me quite a bit. But also in our explorations down there, we just went off on some back roads. And I remember coming up on, it was probably a dirt road that we were on, far away now from the highways and where you can see or hear the sound of cars and, freeways, that sort of thing. Way out in the countryside, and going along a dirt road, it was slightly rolling, little patches of woods here and there, and maybe not even little patches. But we were coming along this road, and there were a few trees along lining the road there a bit. but pretty sparse and open to the field beyond, in which there was several Amish men out there working the field. I believe they were, cutting hay, mowing hay, and then which they had done. And now they had this rather large wagon. I think it was drawn by probably at least two horses, and just slowly pulling the wagon along over the field. And as it was going, there were, I don't know, maybe two men on each side with pitchforks. They were just throwing up the hay onto the wagon. It was just beautiful. You'd see the pitchfork coming up, the hay going down into the wagon. And there was a rhythm to it. So it's like one from one side, and two on the other side, and three on the backside, and four again, and then just kind of repeating. And so the hay was just coming up in this steady, beautiful rhythm. The horses very slowly, at the pace that the men were throwing up the hay, were walking along. I don't remember now if there was someone leading the horses or not. But it was just beautiful. Today, I would have pulled up my phone and probably started filming this. It was, but it certainly was implanted on my mind. But when we saw this, it was a little sports car I was driving at that time, open top and all that. But it was making its own noise. We saw this. I stopped the car, turned off the engine, and then we got out of the car and we just stood there and watched this in amazement. And how quiet it was. And that was the thing about it. It was so quiet. When I turned off the car, it was just silence. Maybe there was a bit of a breeze. If there was, it wasn't much. Maybe just stirring some leaves, perhaps, in the foreground. I don't really recall that. What I would recall is just being stunned by the silence of this scene. And here the men were working, as people have done for centuries before, with horses, with cutting, mowing hay, throwing it up onto the wagon. And these well-trained horses, no doubt, I mean, they were right there with the men working at just the proper pace. It was absolutely beautiful. It was amazing to me, because I hadn't seen that before. I had an uncle with a farm and spent time out there in my youth, but he had tractors and things of this sort. And I remember, different times we'd be harvesting one thing or another, but with the sounds of engines, running and this sort of thing. To be out there in this field and to hear it so quiet, still, and yet it's very productive work taking place there right in front of us. It was just amazing. It's never left me, that scene. And I don't know if I can even impress upon you, it was the quietness of it that was most amazing to me. But when you think about this, this was the way the world was for the most part for up until, the Industrial Revolution, just a couple centuries ago now. And very quiet. And yet, we did things, and we made noise. I remember studying some years ago, and I was for a book that I finally abandoned, but I was studying ancient religions of the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean region. And I remember when they started getting into monumental architecture, finally, building some pretty big structures that we even know today in the ruins we see of these things. But one of the main fears that these people had at that time was they were afraid they would make the gods angry because they were making so much noise. But how much noise could they be making? They didn't have gasoline engines, and maybe they would have made a little bit more noise than these handful of men out in the field mowing hay, taking in hay, and onto a horse-drawn wagon. But But how much noise would it be? But I think about this when I contemplate that line, why am I afraid of this unadorned quietude? Unadorned. Of course, maybe that word was thrown in because there was noise in the community among people at that time. But here is this, maybe just speaking of real silence. And as I sit here now, I do hear a bird. I don't know if you could hear it through my mic or anything. But I also hear a jet plane. There's been a guy going by here, apparently, somebody anyway, it sounds like a motor with a muffler missing. But this is in the city. And I'm just next door to the center here, where I am right now speaking from. But there's all these, sounds all the time. But here at this time, when someone, why am I afraid of that unadorned? And perhaps it truly was, and maybe they were so sensitive to noise that they did draw a distinction even then between, say, the noise of whatever kind of construction would go on in urban areas and as opposed to being out on the countryside. But surely not like we experience today. But I think it's helpful for us to keep this in mind, what is being said here and why it's being said. Why am I afraid of this? Why am I afraid of the quietude? And this is something maybe we should ask ourselves, particularly in this age that we live in now, where we can easily distract ourselves with noise and with all sorts of things and activities, with our phones and the machines and jet planes and just on and on, with construction of all sorts. We live in to the ancients, this would be just a cacophonous, noisy place where we live now. And yet even when we get to a place where we feel like we've found a little bit of quietness, we can still find quietude. I know a couple of you who are out there in very quiet places right now, but most of us are in cities, and we might go looking for places, this sort of thing. But there's things that we can be considering here, that this apparently was something important to one such as the Buddha, back in an age that knew quiet, profound silence, quietude, in a way that we can barely experience today. This was important even then. And yet, here we are in a place where we can't help it, if we're among other people living in our modern societies now today, we're bound to hear all of this noise. And so easily we can distract ourselves. I know some people who, they can't bear to go home to a quiet place. The first thing they do is turn on the television as soon as they get home. They're not going to watch it necessarily. They just need noise in the room or the radio or something, And of course, we have all our little devices now. There's any sorts of things that we can have. Yeah, if we're not even engaging in it, but it's making some sound in the background. How often do we consider this or even look at this? Or even ask ourselves, what effect does this have on me? And why? Why do I feel this necessity of having something other than just this silence, this quietude? We're afraid of the quietude. I remember as a boy, it was out near where my uncle's farm was, and there was a place out there. It was sort of like a tavern restaurant kind of a place out on an intersection of a couple of roads out where he had his farm, nearby. And behind this place, I remember one night, there was something going on with the family in terms of, I don't know if it was a wedding celebration afterward or whatever, But there was some big celebration going on. It was a family sort of thing. And I wasn't a little boy at this point. I might have been 10, 11, I don't know. And I remember as evening was coming, it was summertime, evening was coming on, it was getting darker, and they're kind of celebrating, eating and whatever. I guess there was probably some dancing going on there, perhaps, and music and stuff. And I remember at some point, I went out behind. I noticed there was a back way out of this place, and I just went back there and kind of down a little bit of a hallway and out into sort of like a screen door or something. I don't know. Anyway, I stepped out onto kind of a small porch platform sort of a thing, and I looked, and in the dimming light, it was still twilight. I was looking toward the west, and there's still twilight, you know, just silhouetting the trees and this sort of thing. And out there, I think I was aware of this already, but there was like a small lake or a pond, you know. It was private because there was nothing around it. There were no lights around it or building or structures of any kind other than this place that I just stepped out from. And it was just gorgeous out there. And again, the sound, the quiet, I could hear, if I remember, it was either crickets or maybe some kind of, I don't know, green frogs or something, I don't know what, but I don't remember the sound for sure, but I think it was crickets, that's sort of how I remember it. But, and they were really, you know, making, but it was such a wonderful sound of the wild and something that we weren't producing. And I walked away from the building and down toward this lake and, or pond, whatever it was. And here in Minnesota, we things get to be what they call lakes in other states, and we still call them ponds. So, but it had some size to it. But anyway, just going down there, I'll never forget this, and noting the shift in my feeling, in how I was in my mind, and I felt this, and I was just a kid, really. But how unsettled could I be, you know? But I remember it just. Yeah, and of course, I didn't know about the Buddha's experience as a child when he sat and just there were some proceedings going on around him there, and he just kind of watched his breath and settled down. But I do remember this feeling, and how I also remember, and I have known since this time, that in times when I'm alone, very alone. I go off into the wilderness once in a while here and there. I've done this. And we just, at some point, you kind of just feel kind of lonely and you miss people. And that's sort of what I probably had experienced up to this point. But I do remember being out there. And of course, there were people right behind me, not too far away, family. And but I remember this shift in my mind, where I really wanted this quiet and this settledness, and where it was far more appealing to me than all the noise and the hoopla and the excitement and the fun. It was a fun time that was going on there at this place. But that was new to me, I think, at that time. And I had a, you know, pretty profound taste of it. It hit pretty hard. And I don't know if that ever really left me. I do remember then later, and as I was growing up and having more opportunities to get off with my friends up in, here in northern Minnesota, we have what's called the Boundary Water Canoe Area, the boundary with Canada. And it goes up into Canada, the Quetico up in Canada. Just interconnected rivers and lakes. And I started going up there as a teenager with my friends. And I remember at one point where I saw somebody coming out when we were going in, and it was just a man by himself. He was on a solo trip, apparently. It never dawned on me that I could do this, you know. But That stuck with me for a while until finally I took a solo trip, and I'd taken quite a few since, but I don't do this anymore. I'm too old now. In fact, I don't do the canoeing anymore. I can hardly walk with a canoe without falling down. So anyway, but I did start to play then with this feeling of, it seemed like maybe I had this craving or something like that, you know, this need to be alone and to be quiet and to be settled. And as I got older and more independent and I was able to drive, I had my own car, that sort of thing, I took a number of trips out west into desert places and mountains, and just to be alone. And, or into the boundary waters or the Quetico. And and there'd be this time in your first days, it was hard for me at times, because at times suddenly there's just this aching feeling of wanting to have somebody with me, you know, would kind of come over. But then it would subside again. And I'm just left there with that solitude, the quietude. I think all I'm trying to say here is that, as the Buddha points out, you know, ask ourselves this question: why am I afraid to be alone, to be quiet, to be still? What is going on with a mind that has difficulty with that, as opposed to, say, a mind that can just sink into that, settle into that, at least for a time? Or at least so that every time you come home, you don't need to turn on the TV or something just to make sound. This is important, I think, for those of us who, last time I spoke, I was stressing, you know, if you want to wake up, if you want to be awake, if you want to live out of awakeness, this is very important. I often point out to you, just watch your mind. Well, I'm talking about things like this. Notice what's going on in your mind, in your heart, and what it is you might be craving for or reaching for or feeling that you need to take up or set down. You need to take up what to stimulate you, to make noise, to distract you. What about those moments that are settled around you? Are you settled? Can you settle? It's important just to give some notice to this. I'm not saying that you should always be trying to settle yourself and to quiet yourself, but notice when you leave that, when you're disturbed, when you're longing for something, reaching for something that will, I don't know, comfort you in some particular, as if you were needy. Because what we can find out is that when it comes to what is truly real in your life and that you experience directly, you are not in need of this. You have this. And if you realize this, that this is already yours, you can go into the quiet place or the noisy place. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where you are. You have this strength and power in yourself. Not exactly to be independent, because you're not independent. Nothing is independent. We're all living out this life, which isn't our life. It isn't your life or my life. But we can realize it. We can wake up to this. That isn't just me. If it's just me, then I'm just this little thing here facing what? A whole world that could be cold and stark and empty and loveless and all of this. But that's really not the case. It is only the case in our minds, in our thinking, in our worrying about being pleased, about being happy. When we worry about this, when we grasp this, when we reach for things to try to satisfy that, we don't realize just how much we disturb our minds and how much we make ourselves dependent on something that you'll never obtain, instead of waking to and settling down in that which is granted all the time. And that this is this world of fullness, of wholeness. You know, so this is something very, very important to contemplate. Also, when we approach our practice in a way where we are open to the whole, or when we get outside of just our petty little concerns, our immediate concerns of self, everything is quite different at that time. And the way we would approach practice, or the way we understand practice, or what it is that we're doing when we're sitting in meditation, is radically changed. It's different from how we might otherwise be. If it's me, if I am the one who's practicing, I am taking up sitting, I am doing this, I need to get in so many hours a day, I'm signed up for the practice period, I have to do this schedule, I have to stick to, well, maybe today I don't feel like, or I can't. I can make up for it. You know, all of this kind of stuff, the bargaining and the rationalizing. If you're watching your mind, notice at some point, just stop, quiet down, and notice that mind that is doing that. That is not a settled mind. That is not a quiet mind. That is not a mind that is undisturbed by quietude. And with that mind, then we want to practice, and we'll practice with ideas like, well, okay, then if I do this, then maybe I can become enlightened, which we might view as being freed of all of these kinds of vexations. And then the way to get there then is, well, if I'll, that's why I'm going to practice this meditation. And even though we tell you, over and over and over and over and over again, I mean for years, decades even, and you practice diligently and seriously, with sincerity and honesty, up to a point where, well, before you become distracted by your thinking. Now you're, it's not like you're still not doing this. Your heart's probably still there, at least you want it to be. But you're distracted, and you're thinking. And now you're practicing with the idea that, well, if I follow my breath, my mind will become quiet. Or if I follow my breath, then maybe I can gain enlightenment. But here I've been practicing this now for years, and still it doesn't bring me to enlightenment. Well, nobody ever said that it would. We teach here at Dharmafield, people in the school that I trained in, Zazen is useless. It means you can't use it for some end, even, well, to finally bring you to enlightenment. It simply doesn't work that way. It's simply a matter of see if you can sit down and not be disturbed by that quietude. And that is all it is. It is just that. If you're thinking, okay, I've been doing this now for a while, but I, you know, but not, this is disturbance. Recognize that. And in all the forms that it can show up in any number of ways. It's limitless. I can't begin to describe all the ways that we disturb ourselves. A quiet mind is a quiet mind that's perfectly situated and settled in quietude, which is reality as a whole, has that characteristic, so to speak, except that's not quite right either. But there it is. But what we need to do is to, well, pay attention. Notice what you are doing. Notice the kind of mind that you're practicing with. Is it a quiet mind? I mean quiet. Completely quiet, where even the heart isn't mumbling something. Is it a quiet mind, or is it a bargaining mind or a mind that's keeping score or keeping a tab or measuring progress or whatever. That's not a quiet mind. But that line that Jed gave us last week of the Buddha, when he said, why am I afraid of that unadorned quietude? This is what's taking place here. We're afraid. There's a kind of fear that is there, that we feel like we have to avoid something, quietude, I guess, the very thing that we say we want to experience or know or realize or live out. We're afraid of it. I remember in my own life and in my own practice, I was at it for quite a while by this time, but I started just tasting this fear, blinding fear from nowhere. And I kept trying to just shake myself out of it whenever it happened. Until I started to realize, something's going on here. I want to face this. I want to see what this is. I never did exactly see what it is. I don't think it was anything other than just fear. But it was sort of like maybe my mind, in its last desperate effort, was just trying to keep me distracted. And it was just simply a matter of looking at it and facing the fear. You finally realize, I realized there was nothing here to be afraid of. There's nothing to be afraid of in sitting quietly, doing nothing. Which is, we have all kinds of koans that point to this in various ways, So sitting quietly, doing nothing. The sun rises, the flowers bloom. There are things we need to do, but then we do them as they come up. Take care of them. But this matter of quietude and awakening to this, and to still be caught without catching yourself that you're caught on, you're operating from an idea that I need to do this practice so that I can something, wake up or whatever. Even though we're told over and over and over and over and over again that this isn't going to help you at all. This is an ordinary mind that carries on like that. Not an awakened mind. Still, but this is what you should, just look at this. How is it you can keep coming back to this and keep hearing this, and yet as soon as you walk out of the zendo or, a minute or two later, you've already forgotten. And then we hear it again. We hear it because we hear it over and over again. When do we look at that? When do we just settle down, take a good, quiet look at what we're doing? Yeah. I probably said, I guess, everything that I was thinking about here. But do you have any questions about what I've said this morning? I'm not scolding you. I hope it doesn't come off that way at all. Because I'm just trying to urgently just kind of point as sharply as I can to what this practice is and what you need to be doing. And in this huge area where it's not just you, me too, where we slide off into what's not necessary. We can also take on all kinds of ritualized ceremony and practice and this sort of thing. That's very distracting. There's nothing wrong with that as long as you know what you're doing, but you really got to know what you're doing in terms of what's going on in your mind. What are you telling yourself? And if you get to a point where, somebody, bestows a robe upon you, or I've done all these things. I've trained in Japan at monasteries. I've done all of this stuff. It's not necessary. Or it is. I don't know. But what you have to do, I mean, because you can be so distracted by endless things, but what you have to do is pay attention to your own heart, your own mind, and realize how you're taking up this practice. There's nothing special about it, even if we end up wearing some special thing. I'm very inclined right now, as I have been at various periods in my life, to just not... I don't wear most of the robes anyway, but even maybe the rakusu. Only because it doesn't bother me any, but I don't want to disturb you. Or maybe those of you who have been coming on a pretty regular basis, maybe less so now, but new people showing up. Well, is this something? Because that's where we go. Why should I be wearing anything kind of different? When new people showing up, well, probably they could easily fixate on that. Steve mentioned in some class or a talk or whatever, how I used to use in a class, I forget what class it was, but I had my little stuffed animal George, little stuffed monkey, and I could kind of wiggle him a little bit so he could nod and turn his head a little bit and stuff. And I use it in that class to just kind of help to illustrate how quickly, as soon as I bring George up out of this little brown bag that I would carry him in with, immediately, everybody, we just focus on George. Or like Roshi, seeing the moose. Steve talked about that last week. Something the whole universe is just moose, you know. and that's quite natural, that's fine. But realize what's going on there. And wearing things like this, I don't know, you know. On the other hand, I can give you some darn good reasons for why I should continue wearing it too. Don't take it like I'm against this. No, I'm not against it. I'm not. But my concern, I'm trying to help point out what's helpful for you in terms of waking up. I only want to help you wake up. I don't want to teach you doctrine necessarily. You can read all that stuff on your own. If you have questions, I'd be happy to talk with you about all that kind of stuff. But I'm trying to help you in waking up. And there's distractions everywhere. We live in a very noisy world today. We have some fear in us. I had a fair amount, apparently, but of facing quietude. But still, you can face it, even in a noisy world, and learn not to be too distracted. Of course, we can't tune out the noisy world. You have to pay attention. All of that. But this is just a practice of awareness. That's all. It's not awareness for something or to get you to something or whatever. But the enlightenment is here. Awakening is here. Reality is here. This is about learning not to leave. Just stay here. Mike, you got a question?
Yeah. So if we have fear of this unadorned quietude, then the thing to do is take a look at our own minds.
I would say so. That's where the fear resides. That's where it's coming up.
And
anyway.
See where that's coming from.
Yeah, I would say no. You've gone a little too far.
Too far?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just look at it.
Okay.
Of course, I realize that's not well. And then, but we went on. And then, what should I find? I'm not gonna tell you that.
Okay.
Because that's beside the point. Whatever it is you see, if you grasp it, it's delusion. So I don't want to give you something there to grasp. Last week, for example, when I was listening to Jed's lecture, I was coughing all the time, and that would have been a distraction. And I don't want to distract in any way. That's why I really questioned wearing stuff like this. I don't want to distract people. But as I said, I can give you some good reasons for maybe I should. But anyway. But it's all like that. But just watch your mind. Don't grasp this. Don't grasp. I'm just pointing things out. I'm not pointing them out for you to grasp them. I'm pointing things out for you to notice. if you think I'm suggesting take hold of this or do the opposite and throw that away and go over, you know, I'm not. I'm only, if you listen carefully to everything that I've said over as long as I've been teaching, or at least for the last 30 years at least, basically I'm just trying to point things out to you. That's all. And I'm not saying this is how you should think or this is what you should believe or what. No, I don't think you should believe in it or think in any particular way. I don't hold any particular beliefs, really. Momentarily, maybe, if they're functional and useful in the moment. But I know that reality can't be grasped as a thing or an idea or a concept. They might be useful, so I'll use them briefly and then set them down. So as you hear Dharma teaching, it's just pointing. I guess maybe it was the last time I spoke. Yeah, I forgot now what my topic was exactly. Oh, yeah, if you want to wake up. I mentioned Nagarjuna, but I should have pointed out, it's right at the end of the Mula Majjhima Karika where Nagarjuna praises the Buddha as, you know, the great teacher who showed us the relinquishment of all views. And I don't know if I worded that quite right, but I don't know if I have it around here now or not. But I was just kind of reviewing this past week a little bit, and I forgot. Yeah, that's how it ends. The relinquishment of views. So here we have the Nagarjuna quoting the Buddha saying that, and we have Dogen, as I pointed out last week, and we have Wangpo. I always, you know. It's this relinquishing of views. So I'm not trying to give you more views, more things to hang on to. I don't tell you that Zazen is a good thing to do. I don't tell you it's a bad thing to do. I don't tell you what to expect from it. I wouldn't expect anything. I don't expect anything from Zazen. And yet I do this. I've done this practice now for over 50 years. I probably did expect things at the beginning, but I haven't. That's faded away long ago. Anyway, while I'm kind of rattling on here, there was another question. That was Leonard. Did you have a question?
Hi, Steve, yes.
Yeah.
Well, so, Steve, I mostly live alone and mostly in quietude, but I find myself doing something lately I've never done in my entire life. And that is, all of a sudden, I find myself like humming and singing to myself.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel very frivolous and unmindful when I do that. Yeah, I guess in the past, I don't know, but it's...
Well, that's something that you can notice. Say, if you are being frivolous or unmindful or whatever, and just notice that. And if that's the case, we'll just see if you can alter that. And you can very mindfully or consciously pay attention to what you're singing or whatever, whatever it is you might be doing. And So these are the things we want to just kind of notice, is if the mind is just sort of free floating and drifting. And, or we're just kind of repeating ourselves or babbling. Or if this is just going on in our mind, you know, when people around us don't realize I'm just sitting there. I never watched The Simpsons. Is that still on even? I don't know. The Simpsons, you know that show? It was a kind of an animated thing. I only saw a few snatches here and there. But I do remember one episode, one little piece there where, who's the guy, Homer? Is that his name, Homer? And they kind of had the camera moving in on him, like you're going to get into his mind. And when you finally start tuning in and you're hearing what's going on in his mind, it's sort of like, doo-wop-wah, doo-wop-wah, something like that. You know, and I thought, well, okay. But, and that's fine, but be aware of what you're doing. That's all. That's the whole point. It doesn't matter if you got lofty thoughts here or something else, but just be aware of so we're not just kind of sliding through life asleep. That's really all it is. To the extent that we begin to watch our mind or get used to noticing what's going on in the mind will quiet down. It will settle down. You cannot make it settle down. You're going to try it. Oh, okay, I'm not going to think anything. I'm just going to... Well, you're actually disturbing it. You might feel like you're getting it quiet in a certain way for a little while, but in the long run, that doesn't work. Just pay attention. That's why I always say just watch your mind. Because to the extent that you're noticing what's going on in your mind, and if it starts to turn out to be nothing but a bunch of babble or something like this, you won't be able to keep it up, not if you're aware of it.
So, I took very much part you wrote one time when if you find yourself noticing that you're unmindful, then you're being mindful.
Yeah, exactly. except at that point, you probably slip from it again, because if you're thinking, I'm being mindful, it's just with the mindfulness, just the whole thing drops away, and we're just present, that's all. And when there's time where we have to use something or, you know, engage in some way, but now we're present enough to know that, and then just do that. But don't take hold of anything for too long, if that's possible. Yeah. But that's all. But it's simply a matter of awareness. That's when the Buddha summed up his teaching in a single word, and that was the word. But ultimately, it's objectless awareness. You know, awareness with a capital A. You're not aware of anything in particular. And yet, at the same time, this is really knowing what's taking place. It's full knowing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I saw, Cindy, yeah.
I lost connection with Zoom, so somebody else may have brought this up. But that question about, I can't remember exactly how it's phrased, what am I afraid of? Or
mm-hmm.
The first thing that came up when I just heard you say that this morning is this, a fear of being separate from, I don't know, from others or mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah.
That fear of I can't think of another word for it besides separation.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know there's things that I do sometimes to, it may not be sound so much like turning the radio on, but other kinds of things to, make myself feel like I'm connected. That connection somehow requires an action on my part, and not seeing that it's just the way things are, and that the things that I might do then to make me feel connected actually work against seeing that for myself.
Yeah, they make you feel disconnected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me do this or that or
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah. So we drive ourselves in the opposite direction from where we would want to go. But the whole thing is that it's not a matter of connection even, because there's nothing separate in the first place. But to the extent that we see ourselves as separate, and we set up certain goals, different endpoints we want to reach, and this sort of thing. And then in some limited ways, they might be helpful in some small spheres. But to the extent that we really think that this is the way things are, and here I am, and I got to do these things here to help these people. It could be very noble, you know, things you're trying to do. But you're seeing it in a way that's not, doesn't match reality. Because in reality, there's no separation there in the first place, which we could see if we finally realize quietude, the very thing that we seem to be afraid of. And yet that's the very thing that will be... that's the... What could I say? The resolution of all your difficulty. It's not your difficulty, and that's how it is when you see that. Now what's the problem? Still, there's a suffering world, and this isn't about not engaging, but it is about not grasping. But if you don't see yourself, if to the extent that we're not caught up in our own, you know, concern, immediate concern, me, and I want to do this, and I have to achieve this, and if you're not doing that, if the mind isn't even operating in that way at all, and it's quite possible for it not to, you're not seeing yourself as separate in the first place, and then, so there isn't this loneliness or this, you know, in this quietude, there's no loneliness there at all. I remember once, I've given this before, talking with my teacher, it was just the two of us, we're talking casually one day, and at some point, I don't remember exactly what we were talking about, but I remember he just kind of took a deep breath, and then he just said, he said, I am a man alone in the universe, he said. And then maybe just breathe out or something. And, I don't remember exactly how I took it right at the time, but I realized afterward that I don't know if I did think, you know, oh, poor fellow, he feels so alone. Here he's a Japanese person living in the U.S. and, you know, and not having people that know his culture and language, you know, around him. Well, I had a few people, but most of us, you know, didn't know it and all that sort of thing. Feeling very alone. Well, that wasn't what he was saying. This is in this realize. We are alone. This is our true situation. We're alone, but we're not alone as me, separate and isolated from everything else. I'm alone. You're alone. We're alone as this living reality itself, wholeness itself, totality itself. The life that's being lived out is the life of the world. And if you don't see your life as something other than this, there's no feeling of separation or loneliness or anything else. And it's about as intimate with totality, with everything that is taking place as anything could possibly be. And the love and caring and concern for this and that, whether it's other people or the environment, or you name it, but it's there. It's there as we naturally would be doing what we can to take care of ourselves as well as everyone else. But this is how we do take care of this life as all beings. If we really see this, if we really see this is how it's being lived out in spite of ourselves, this is not difficult to do, and the kind of heartache and other things that we might otherwise experience just aren't there. You don't see yourself other than someone else over there suffering. You don't see yourself connected. You don't see yourself disconnected. You don't see yourself. Or them. That's something other than just this that's being lived out, including yourself. It looks like we're coming up on the hour, though, so maybe, and I don't see any other hands here now. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.